Well, good evening. This is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And, of course, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. But please hold your calls for the time being, because we have with us on the line Pastor David Whitney from the Institute on the Constitution. And we're going to be talking about what separates America from any other nation in the world. You know, only once in 6,000 years has there been a nation where people have been relatively free as they ever have in any other society, where a nation was established where the people acknowledged that their freedom came not from government but from God, and that our rights were only to be not given by government, but governments were instituted among men to protect the God-given rights that God had given us. It was a unique idea. It was made for a moral and religious people. As John Adams said, it would not work for any other group of people, which is, of course, why there was such a conscious effort by those people who hate God and hate freedom and would establish a dictatorship here to destroy the religious foundation of this country. But if you don't understand the religious foundation, you can't understand from whence our freedoms come. You can't understand the Declaration of Independence. You can't understand the Constitution or the Bill of Rights, which is really a restrictive covenant. It limits what the government can do. You see, that's what it was all about. Liberty, limited government. Congress shall make no law. Didn't say the state couldn't make a law. Didn't say the local community or the county couldn't make a law. It said Congress will make no law. It was a restriction on the power of Congress, never on the power of states or the local community. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be abridged. That was a restriction on the power of government over the lives of the people, but not just federal, but all at every level of government, because it didn't limit it just to the federal government. But you go through the Bill of Rights, it was a restriction on the government's ability to control the individual, because our founding fathers realized that it was government that would take away our freedom. People say, oh, you're anti-government. That's very true. Our founding fathers were anti-government. They didn't trust government. They wanted to limit government. They wanted to take the chains off the people and put them onto government. And so with us is Pastor David Whitney from the Institute of the Constitution. And we're going to talk about this wonderful document we have, which is never taught properly in our schools today. And if the American people can't be re-educated about the foundations of our freedom, then freedom as we know it will be lost and lost forever. Go ahead, David.
You're absolutely right, Dr. Stan, and tonight we want to talk about the Declaration of Independence to the Constitution, what took place in that period of time, and what led the colonists to actually assert the very idea of a Declaration of Independence. I know that many people today consider that to be the founding document, and yet many people today disagree with the very philosophy underlying and the very religious beliefs underlying that document, so it's very important to understand that document. You see, the colonists were really not forming a revolution, that is, in changing a system of government. Rather, in the Declaration, they were calling back to the ancient rights of Englishmen, rights that were established all the way back in the time of the Magna Carta. This was not something new. They were saying that King George, he's the one who has rebelled and brought in a revolution to remove our God-given rights that we have as Englishmen. And also they were certainly upset with Parliament's taxation of them without representation. They had no ability to have a say in what Parliament imposed upon them as the colonies. So there was a number of things, but if you understand the history, most of the colonies were established by a colonial charter, and most of the colonies, therefore, were given a degree of autonomy that was very different than how, say, a county in England would be governed more directly by the Parliament and so on. But those English colonial charters many of those were overthrown in the Glorious Revolution of 1688, as the Stuart kings were overthrown and Oliver Cromwell took power. There was a change in which they were given liberties more on the level of the Englishmen in every part of the English realm. And now we had kings, King George III being one, who wanted to take away that kind of liberty and freedom that they were given. And the colonists repeatedly, as the Declaration of Independence states so clearly, repeatedly appealed to the king, repeatedly appealed to Parliament, appealed to their brethren in England for the series of grievances that no Englishman in England would put up with. But he had a say, he had a voice there, and the colonists did not. So as they wrote the Declaration of Independence, as it was drafted by Thomas Jefferson, Benjamin Franklin, John Adams, Roger Sherman, and Robert Livingston, the Congress actually voted not on July 4th. We think of July 4th as the date. They actually voted on July 2nd, and it was July 4th that it was actually adopted. So the vote took place 2 days ahead of the actual date, July 4th. But if you look at the details, and this is very important for our listeners to understand, that the Declaration of Independence states that the colonies were entitled to independence by, and the foundation of this, is the laws of nature and of nature's God. We've talked about this before, Dr. Stan, but it bears repeating. The law of nature is what God, our Creator, has written on human conscience and human reason of His truth, of His law. The laws of nature's God, the other phrase in the Declaration of Independence, refers to revealed law, in other words, the Bible, Scripture, and all of our founding fathers understood that. They knew what that phrase meant. The law of nature's God was the Bible. And they said that they were declaring this in this statement that a decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they state the reasons why they were declaring independence. They next state in the following paragraph that it's self-evident truth, that is, this is one of the laws of nature and of nature's God, that God created everyone. You know, we did not evolve out of some primordial ooze. There is a creator God. He created us, and therefore all men are created equal. In addition to being created equal, all men are endowed by their creator with unalienable rights. Unalienable means that they cannot be removed. Even if a government, which King George III, they are saying, is violating these inalienable rights, he is violating rights that are given to us by God. He cannot take our rights away. He may usurp them, he may violate them, but they are given to us by God. And they say, they mention three, but that is not by any means a complete list. They're just mentioning three. For example, they're saying, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. As we mentioned before, all three of them are rooted in the Ten Commandments. Life in the sixth commandment, thou shalt not kill. Liberty in the first commandment, that God is the author of liberty. And as a matter of fact, it's been a number of years ago, I was in Philadelphia, and it's fascinating to see the Liberty Bell there. And there it is inscribed on the Liberty Bell, Leviticus chapter 25, verse 10, proclaim liberty throughout all the land and unto the all the inhabitants thereof. God is the author of liberty. Our founders understood that, and they stated that right here in the Declaration. And that phrase, pursuit of happiness, is much misunderstood, Dr. Stan. I was presenting to Senate here in Maryland as a state legislature and opposing a piece of homosexual agenda that would just push their evil further down the throats of the state of Maryland, and discussing afterwards with one of the homosexual presenters who was opposing my stand, and he was saying, well, of course I have the right to my lifestyle, he called it. We would say his evil perversion. I have the right because the Declaration says that I have the right to my pursuit of my happiness. I said, that is not what the founders meant whatsoever. By that phrase, the pursuit of happiness, they meant the pursuit of virtue, because they stated in their writings very clearly that only a virtuous people, only a righteous people, only a people following God's law can truly be happy.
Well, you know, I think, David, the founding fathers were all coming from a a certain position. They were coming from a Christian worldview, and their views had been shaped by the people who had been writing for the previous several hundred years. Now, tragically, they've dumbed down the American people today, and most of them don't have any idea where these ideas or phrases came from. And, of course, you can look through the evolution of English law from the time of the Magna Carta back in 1215 on, but one of the most important writers who profoundly influenced the thought process of men like Thomas Jefferson was a man named John Locke, and I'm sure you well know that he had written about nature's God and nature's law. He had written about the rights of all men. In fact, men were entitled to be free because God had made us free, and basically we were entitled to life, liberty, and property. And that was one of the phrases that he used over and over again. And the whole idea, initially in the Declaration of Independence, was among those inalienable rights would be life, liberty, and property. And somebody substituted the word pursuit of happiness. But that phrase, life and liberty and property, you'll find that twice in the Declaration, in the Constitution. And every place you see life and liberty mentioned, then you will see the Lockean phrase, the property. So these were the writings of John Locke, who profoundly impacted on the Declaration of Independence, as did Gladstone, who repeated that idea of nature's God and nature's law and life, liberty, and property. And then, of course, Samuel Rutherford had written Lex Rex, a Scots theologian who talked about the law is king. And then, of course, all men are created equal. All men are created in sin. The king is created in sin. The people are created in sin. If everybody is created in sin, what right does the king have to lord it over people? And so when Thomas Jefferson wrote those words, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, he was referring back to Rutherford.
That's right.
And the people at that time understood this, what he was saying, and that's why they thought this was such a marvelous document, because he had managed to encapsulate in a few short words the writings of the great philosophers of the last several hundred years.
That's right. And, you know, the thing that they go on to state, which, again, people today, I think, have a very difficult time understanding, is that the purpose of civil government, that civil government is instituted to secure these rights. That's the right to life, the right to liberty, the right to property, the right to pursue virtue. That's the purpose of government. You ask most government officials, you know, what's the purpose of government? And they'll give you some socialist mumbo-jumbo about creating a level playing field. Really what they mean, however, to understand, is that they're there to redistribute wealth, to steal from Peter in order to give it to Paul. And that's not at all the purpose of government. That's theft by just another name. But the Declaration states that government, civil government's sole purpose is to secure our God-given rights. And that further, that government only has any power, it only derives just powers from consent of the governed. That is, we, the people, are the ones that grant power to the government. The government has no power of its own. It's only power granted, delegated by we, the people. Another important distinction that's made here is that people have rights. Inalienable rights are only for people. Government, civil government, has no rights. Civil government only has power that has been delegated by we, the people. The next point that they make in the Declaration is that government may be altered, or government may be and should be abolished or altered when it violates these principles. That is, when government no longer secures our God-given rights. If government begins to violate our God-given rights, then we, the people, have another God-given right, and that is to abolish that government or to reform that government and change it such that it will be fulfilling its God-given purpose to secure our rights. They also say, however, that people should only abolish a government after a long train of abuses and usurpations, and they go into a list of 28 specific usurpations and speak of a long train of abuses that the colonies suffered under the hands of the king and under the hands of Parliament. They talk about people being hauled off and denied a trial by jury and transported back to England for trial. So obviously they wanted to be certain that you were going to be tried by a jury of your peers in the community in which the crime was committed. These sort of things that stated in, not in the Declaration, but stated in the Constitution, are connected with the abuses of the king and the abuses of Parliament that they suffered under. They were wanting to be sure the new form of government would not follow down that same tyrannical path. Well, we don't need to look at all 28, but I encourage your listeners to read, and read very carefully, those 28 lists of abuses. And they come to the end of that list, and they say this, Dr. Stan, the king basically is unfit to be the ruler of a free people. Basically, they're saying he has unthroned himself. That is, if we understand that God is the one who's given us God-given rights, that government's whole and sole purpose is to secure those rights. If a government fails to do it, that government is no longer a legitimate or a valid government. It just waits to be pushed over. It waits to be gotten rid of because it is failing to fulfill its creator, God's purpose for it. And therefore, they saw themselves servants of the sovereign God, or as they would say, their famous slogan during the War for Independence, no king, but King Jesus. Jesus is sovereign. They were serving Jesus by getting rid of King George, who was failing to serve Jesus. That would be a way to summarize what their view was and what was taking place in the War for Independence. And they state that these United Colonies are and of a right ought to be free and independent states. Here again, a very important understanding of their conception of the nation they were, nation probably is not the best term, the country they were founding. It was not a country that we see today. Most people think of the United States as a nation, one big block. They saw, no, it's 13 separate independent colonies that are going to cooperate and participate together, but each of those states is a free and independent government of its own. And that idea was viciously attacked and destroyed in the war between the states, which brought about the beginning of our humongous, overreaching, overbearing, and out-of-control tyrannical federal government that we suffer under today, which is completely opposite of what our founding fathers envisioned and stated right here in the Declaration of Independence. That was not their vision for the country they were founding. So here in the Declaration, their basic ideals of the new nation are set forth. In a sense, really, we should see the Declaration as a preamble to the Constitution, because it states the purposes, it states the philosophy, it states the theology. Really, it is a theology of what it means to be one nation under God. And a lot of people, again, think that somehow our founding fathers did not have a view that God was the sovereign of their nation, of their country, but they did. Let me just read this last paragraph, the beginning of the last paragraph of the Declaration. We, therefore, the representatives of the United States of America in General Congress, assembled appealing to the supreme judge of the world for the rectitude of our intentions. And then they go on from there. Their appeal was to Almighty God. And their communication to the rest of the world was, these are the reasons why, but our true appeal, our true justification comes from God, because he's the one that's given us life, liberty, and happiness, and the pursuit of happiness, those God-given rights. And he's the one that has given us the right, indeed the duty, to overthrow a tyrant and to, in his place, establish a just form of government founded upon the law of God.
And I think that's so important, David, is for the average person to realize that you cannot mention this in our schools today. Why? Well, very simply, because a group of people had taken over our Supreme Court and taken God and prayer out of our schools. And these people worshipped a different God, and they really wanted to destroy the foundations of our freedom. And you have to destroy that first by destroying a belief in God. And they were looking for future generations. After all, the Supreme Court opens its sessions every day when a crier comes in and says, God save the United States and this honorable court. Mm. So the Supreme Court justices heard that every single day.
Yes.
And yet, of course, they would vote that it was there was a wall of separation between church and state. They knew it didn't exist. But they figured that the average American would go along with it. After all, it was the right thing to do. It was the legal thing to do. After all, the judges tell us what the Constitution says. No, tragically, the judges had an agenda, and it was an agenda of destroying this country. We have judicial activism, we have judicial tyranny. Thomas Jefferson said he saw the seeds of the dissolution of our form of government within the judiciary. Yeah. It's time to take America back, and you've got to help us educate the American people. Mm-hmm. This was one nation under God. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Pastor David Whitney from the Institute of the Constitution. And what we are talking about is something that has to be repeated over and over again until people can articulate it, until people can understand it, until people can remember the wording of our Declaration and then defend their position. Actually, in the Declaration, there are four separate places where they talk about God. Actually, nature's God and nature's law, you're going to include both of those as two. Why, it would be five times, but at least four times the Declaration refers to God. There's no question that this would be the foundation upon which the Constitution was built. Everybody knew that 200 years ago, but of course, in an intentional effort, organized and orchestrated to dumb down our people, they have removed this teaching from our schools for a generation, and I suspect that many people listening to this program, other than listening to a program such as ours, have never heard this discussed or articulated, and certainly you're not going to hear this discussed in our churches, because 50 years ago, the enemies of freedom infiltrated our seminaries and began to change the teaching there at one time, why ministers were taught that they were responsible for what happened in society as well as preaching the gospel. And what the enemies of freedom did, and this comes from David Horowitz, who came from a communist family and told my good friend Colonel Ron Ray this. He said, we infiltrated the seminaries 50 years ago, and the idea was to teach the ministers that their only purpose was to preach the gospel. And what a good job they've done today. Well, go ahead, pick that up for David.
Well, you know, as soon as they signed this, and of course they realized that, they immediately put a big bullseye on each one of their heads. As one said that, you know, if we don't, we'll all hang separately if we don't hang together. But they immediately had no government. That is, they had to go back to their own individual colonies that were now independent states and ratify state constitutions. In addition, they needed a constitution or a form of government for all 13 colonies to, or now 13 states, to operate together. So it was drafted by John Dickinson in 1776, the Articles of Confederation. This was the first form of government in our land. It was approved the following year in 1777, and it was more of a compact among states than a true constitution. Just briefly to mention some of the purposes, they said it was a league of friendship for common defense, security of liberty, and mutual welfare. There was many weaknesses in this Articles of Confederation. For example, paying for the war for independence was very expensive, and there was no real federal taxing authority at all. It was only voluntary requisition, so Congress could send out to each of the 13 states and say, you know, we've got this bill for $1 million here, and who'd like to contribute? Well, it didn't work very well, because the state said, well, you know, maybe if we've got a little extra after everything else is taken care of, we'll contribute. So there really was some financial struggles that developed through the Articles of Confederation. Furthermore, there was a committee of states that could act when Congress was in recess, and so there was some confusion about jurisdictional authority. Actually, Canada, this is one of the interesting things about the Confederation, they had hoped in some sense that Canada might join them, and so there was a clause that would allow Canada to join their Confederacy. Another enormous problem they had was that there was no federal enforcement powers at all.
So hold that thought for just a minute. We want to bring our other stations right back with us right now. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here. Our guest this evening is Pastor David Whitney from the Institute of the Constitution. And David spends his full time, when he's not, of course, working in his church, trying to educate people about this wonderful document that separated America from any other nation there has ever been. Because at one time, of course, we truly were the city on the hill. We were the lighthouse. We were the beacon of freedom for all men. hardly today, in fact, increasingly people throughout the world hate our form of government. They feel we're a bully. We're forcing our will on other nations. We have troops stationed in 130 different nations. We're pushing the world towards world government and this new world religion, atheist religion, and the finances and the power of America being used for purposes that our founding fathers never could have accepted. But tragically, the good people have allowed the wicked people to take positions of power. So pick up from there, David, and carry on the story.
We're talking about the era between the Declaration and the Constitutional Convention, and that was the era governed by the Articles of Confederation. There was a number of weaknesses. There was a Congress, but in the Articles of Confederation, there was no chief executive, there was no federal judiciary, and so the events of that era leading up to the Constitutional Convention began to show the weaknesses and the gaps in the Articles of Confederation. There was a combined inflation and recession. Basically, there was no combined currency, and currency wasn't fixed to any standard, and so each state had their own currency, and sometimes even banks developed their own currency. This was a very difficult process of doing business when there wasn't any standardization of currency. Congress, as we mentioned earlier, was unable to really raise money except by making requests to the states. There was Shays' Rebellion, and so domestic disturbances were raising some real concerns about the ability to govern effectively. Then there was border problems among the states, one state treating another citizens of the other state as if they're foreign aliens and treating them as foreign nations, and a number of different border problems erupted with Canada and with the Spanish in the West. And during the war, actually, during the War for Independence, Hamilton had been writing a number of letters urging stronger government, but actually had gotten nowhere. No one really was listening to his urgings until late in the process. He had written a letter in 1785, or actually just before that, to George Washington. And when George Washington read it, it changed his mind such that in 1785 he wrote a letter to all 13 states urging a constitutional convention. And that began the ball rolling. First it was just a trade conference that was called in 1786, but only five states showed up, so it really wasn't a quorum to do anything at all. And then Congress in 1787 called for a constitutional convention to be held in Philadelphia. And in May of 1787, it was called for the sole purpose, quoting their statement, for the sole and express purpose of revising the Articles of Confederation. So our Constitution came out of a meeting that was initially just to revise the Articles of Confederation. And as of May 14, 1787, only two delegates from two states had arrived, so there wasn't a quorum that could begin until later that month, the 25th of May. But during that period of time, the 14th of May to the 25th, a very significant thing took place. The Virginia delegation, using their time effectively, sat together and produced what's called the Virginia Resolves. Madison was a chief leader in this, James Madison, and that Virginia Resolves actually became the agenda for the Constitutional Convention when they began to meet May 25th through September 17th of the year 1787. 55 delegates from 12 states. Actually, Rhode Island never sent a delegation to the Constitutional Convention at all. Many of these delegates, if you were to look at their names, these were very intelligent, experienced, educated men who had a great background, 31 trained in the law, 19 military veterans, 28 former congressmen, two college presidents, three college professors, nine who had come from foreign countries and emigrated to our land, doctors, scientists, an array of extremely intelligent, brilliant men. And the delegates agreed on some basic values and principles. They agreed on what we just talked about in the Declaration. The laws of nature and of nature's God were the foundation of any just and righteous government. And the government they were forming in the Constitutional Convention was based upon the laws of nature and of nature's God. The Declaration really is the preamble to the Constitution.
All right, we're going to be back here in just a few minutes with Pastor David Whitney from the Institute of the Constitution. Of course, we're going to welcome your calls from out across America. at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Remember, once our enemies of freedom succeed in centralizing all power in Washington, D.C., why, the freedom as we've known it will cease to exist. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Pastor David Whitney. What's the hardest thing, I think, for many people to realize is there really are people in government who are intent upon power. They really don't care about the Constitution. The tragedy is that we have members of our Senate who consistently vote in violation of the Constitution. They know they're violating the Constitution. But you see, if they can expand the power of the government, why, they, of course, prosper much more readily. They, after all, if you can do favors for very powerful people, for instance, the drug companies, you pass legislation that takes care of them, they're going to take care of you after you get out of office. If you can pass a legislation that will be favorable to the banks, they're going to take care of you. And this is how the system works. And that's why, initially, our senators were not to be elected by the people. They were to be answerable to the state legislatures. They were to represent the states. It was only those who wanted to convert us from a republic into a democracy that wanted the direct election of senators. That was the 17th Amendment. And with the passage of the 17th Amendment, under the auspices of the Woodrow Wilson administration, but under the guidance of a very evil and wicked man named Colonel Edward Pandell House, did we begin moving away from our traditions that we had, where we had statesmen in the in the Senate, to the point where we are today, where we have some of the finest legislators that money could buy. So pick up the story from there, David.
Yes, our delegates to the Constitutional Convention, they agreed in terms of the religious point of view that the laws of nature and of nature's God were the founding law of any society that seeks to be just, and therefore they were in agreement with that. They were in agreement with what the Declaration also stated, that God has given us unalienable rights, life, liberty, and property, and that government is established by a covenant that is a contract that we, the people, enter into with our civil government, and that the people give government only such limited power as we, the people, choose to delegate to that government. All people, they agreed, rulers included, have a sinful nature, and therefore you must not only bring order to society, but rulers need limits just as much as the people need limits. So these are the philosophy and the religious beliefs of the founders as they gathered there at the Constitutional Convention on the civil government. They were in agreement on these things, and that has been lost as people have torn the Constitution apart and tried to make it out to be a secular document. It is not a secular document. And if you link the Declaration as the preamble with the Constitution, you understand the thinking of our founders in what they wrote. Well, they established procedures as they began to meet there at the end of May in 1787.
Hold that thought for just a moment, David. We're going to bring... There we are. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course, with us right now is Pastor David Whitney from the Institute of the Constitution. So go ahead and pick up this story there, and then just in a moment or two, why we want to tell people how they can get in touch with the Institute, and how they can get a kit, and how they can begin imparting the knowledge that you're giving tonight to their people in their church, in their neighborhood, to their friends. We have to rekindle that flickering flame of freedom that is about to be extinguished. We have to get people to understand our Constitution if we hope to maintain our freedom. So pick up the story there, David.
As they established the procedures in the Constitutional Convention, the president was elected. George Washington was elected as president. One vote per state was established. That is, each delegation from each state they would cast as the majority of that state's delegation desired. And to prevent false rumors, the proceedings of the entire convention were kept secret until the last delegate died, and that was James Madison, 1836, and his widow then produced the very first edition of notes on the Constitutional Convention that were taken. No delegate, a rule was established, no delegate could speak more than twice on any issue until all the others had spoken on that issue, and then they could only speak twice by permission of the entire convention. All remarks were to be addressed to the president not to one another. Therefore, him being kind of the moderator to prevent fisticuffs and so forth breaking out between disagreements of various representatives, various delegates. Many issues were resolved by reaching consensus. Three issues, however, required compromise. Representation in Congress. Large states wanted a proportionate representation. Small states, of course, wanted equal representation. Roger Sherman brilliantly suggested a bicameral Congress. That is, two, a House and a Senate. One that would be equal representation, the Senate. The other that would be proportionate representation, the House. The other area that required compromise was how to count in terms of voting and in terms of taxes, how to count slaves. The North, of course, wanted slaves counted for only for taxes, but not for voting, which is kind of hypocritical, you know. And the South, of course, wanted to count slaves for voting, but not for taxes, just the opposite. So they worked out a compromise that a slave would count as three-fifths of a person. Now, in saying that, they were not saying that a slave is not a full person. That's a misinterpretation of what they said. You read the debates and you read what they stated. They were not saying that a slave was any less than a person. What they were saying is that the only way to resolve this difference, North and South, and how to count slaves in terms of voting and taxes was to come to this compromise. And then the third area was the very continuance of slave trade. Many of our founding fathers, most of them believed slavery was wrong, and that most of them believed that slavery would naturally expire on its own. They could see the progression of what was taking place in the history of the colonies, and they could see that slavery was on its way out. It was not going to be economically feasible in the days ahead, and so they said, we cannot end slave trade and end slavery right away, because if we do, we would create enormous problems economically as well as hardship for the slaves. Many people don't realize when they think of, why didn't Thomas Jefferson just set his slaves free? Well, had he set them free, they would not have had a job. They would not have had a way of earning a living, feeding themselves. They could not have provided for themselves. So our founders were in a bit of a rock and a hard place here, recognizing that slavery was wrong, and they wanted to see it done away with, but recognizing that they could not do it quickly. They needed to allow it a process of time, and so they decided that for 20 years, no law could be written that would end slavery. So 1808 was kind of the sunset. Our founders envisioned slavery actually disappearing. Well, an ancestor of mine changed all that, and no one could foresee that Eli Whitney's invention of the cotton gin would revive the economic viability of slavery and the cotton plantations, and all of that changed, which again our founders could not have foreseen. But they were envisioning slavery being gone from these United States by 1808. So those were the three issues that required compromise. But in June, the convention degenerated into discord. And on June 28th, Franklin, and we've quoted this a number of times on your show, his famous appeal for prayer, he appealed that prayer was necessary. That the only way they'd make it through this constitutional convention, the only way they'd establish a just and righteous government was appealing to Almighty God. And they did, although they didn't do it in the formal way that Franklin had hoped for. They did, and the result was obvious, because harmony was restored, progress was resumed after that point in time. Well, in the closing days of the convention, July 26th, a committee on detail was appointed to work out some minor details. On August 6th, the committee on details presented their reports, and the delegates refined it. And on September 8th, the committee on style was appointed to prepare a draft. Gouverneur Morris did most of the writing of the final draft of the Constitution. Then on September 12th, the Committee on Style presented their report. The convention considered it and adopted it with a few minor changes on September 15th. And then the most important day that's often forgotten in the history of our land is September 17th. It ought to be a day when we set aside time to celebrate and think about what was accomplished in the Constitutional Convention, because September 17th was the signing of the Constitution. The majority from each state signed. There was only three delegates who did not: Elbridge Gerry of Massachusetts, George Mason, and Edmund Randolph of Virginia. Randolph later changed his view, and he supported the Constitution, but from Maryland, Luther Martin signed the Constitution and later changed his mind and opposed it. So even in the Constitution Convention, there was some disagreement. As the delegates signed the Constitution, Ben Franklin spoke, and he referred to an etching of the sun on the back of the chair in which George Washington sat, and he said, quote, "I have often, in the course of this session, and the vicissitudes of my hopes and fears as to the issue, looked at that behind the president without being able to tell whether the sun was rising or setting. But now at length I have the happiness to know that it is rising. It is a rising and not a setting sun." As Franklin left the after the signing, as he walked out into the streets of Philadelphia, we're told that a woman confronted him and said, "Mr. Franklin, what form of government have you given to us?" And he replied, a republic, ma'am, if you can keep it." Because he knew it's one simple thing to write on a piece of paper what you intend to have accomplished, and it's an entirely another thing to preserve that republic that was bequeathed to us. And as you have said, Dr. Stan, so frequently, we have had our republic taken from us, and it's time to take it back. And that's what Institute on the Constitution is all about, teaching people these principles that I'm mentioning here tonight. And this is just one small segment of the entire course. It's a 12-week course, half-hour lectures by Dr. John Eisenow, constitutional law professor. And we put together a notebook that gives a detailed outline of each lecture. And we've designed it so a host, and you don't really have to teach this class, you just host it, gather people together, provide a facility, perhaps your home or a room in the church or a civic organization, where you show the videos, and after the video is completed, the half hour, then you lead a discussion, but the discussion's all structured for you with a series of questions that are fill in the blank, and as the host, we give you the answers to those questions, so you look really intelligent, like you know what you're doing, but it doesn't take a lot of expertise. Anyone, anywhere, with any group can do this, and we encourage your people to call us at IOTC at 1-886-730-9796. That's 1-886-730-9796. Or go to our website, iotconline.com. That's iotconline.com, to order your host kit, because Dr. Stan, anyone around the country can do this, and we need to do this, because the only way we're going to recover that constitutional republic that Ben Franklin spoke of, that has to be preserved, the only way we're going to recover is if people understand the form of government that was bequeathed to us by our founding fathers, and then take action, holding our elected officials accountable to the contract that they enter into when they swear an oath to uphold the Constitution, and they're not doing it. We've got to hold them accountable. We've got to replace them with people who will truly follow the Constitution as envisioned, as understood, as written by our founding fathers. Well, following the Constitutional Convention, then, was the ratification debates. That is, each of the states had to ratify the Constitution as it was presented to them. And there was two sides. The Federalist side, that those who believed in sharing power between the federal government and state governments, and the anti-federalists, those who believed that Congress had authorized the convention only to revise the Articles of Confederation, not create a new constitution, and that they believed any defects in the Articles of Confederation could be corrected by a few amendments. And to them, a lack of a Bill of Rights was a very dangerous thing, and they voiced this very effectively, and so a Bill of Rights was drawn up to go along with it, and there were states who did not ratify it until that Bill of Rights was available. They believed that, also the anti-federalists, that a republic could only succeed in a very small nation. A large nation needed to be a loose confederation to remain a republic in its form of government. And they believed there was not enough representations in Congress and no guarantee of reapportionment once the nation grew. That they believe the federal government was granted too much power by the Constitution, and that Congress was dangerous because it controlled both the Treasury and the military, and they believe that judicial review could be dangerous. Now, fascinating, Dr. Stan, because these anti-federalists, they have some very good insights into problems that have developed in our day.
Well, let's go to Karen, who's calling us from Monterey. Hi, Karen. How are you doing?
Good evening. Hi, Dave. Good evening. I have a question to ask about the Constitution being a legal document and the Declaration of Independence being a jurisprudential document. And what is the difference between jurisprudence and the legal document?
That's an excellent question. The idea of the Declaration, of course, is to state the founding principles. In other words, it's stating, we could actually say, the theology of our founding fathers in terms of civil government, why they have a God-given right to establish a new form of government separating from and seceding from, literally seceding from England. And so it gives the reasons why, it gives the theology behind the formation of a government, whereas the Constitution deals more with how does that government function. Declaration says nothing at all about having two houses, a House and a Senate, nothing about whether there's a chief executive or whether there's a judiciary on a state level, federal. All those questions are unanswered by the Declaration. It's merely a statement of, and merely is probably the wrong term here, but it's a statement of purpose, it's a statement of theology. But the Constitution is a statement of the nuts and bolts. How does it come down to working out the power structure between the executive and the legislative and the judicial branches, and what are the separation of powers between the federal government and the local state and local government? So all of those issues were what is worked out in terms of the Constitution. That's my understanding of the difference between those in terms of the terms a legal document versus a jurisprudence document.
Well, I think that the thing is, Karen, that for 100-150 years, everybody knew that the two were inseparable. In fact, if you remember the Gettysburg Address, when Lincoln was standing there at Gettysburg, and he started out 87 years ago, our forefathers brought forth in this continent a new nation conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men were created equal. Now, what was he talking about? He was talking about the Declaration of Independence 87 years ago. Took it right back to 1776. He was giving this in, I think it was 1862. So, or 1863.
Yeah.
Everybody understood that the Declaration of Independence was the foundation upon which our Constitution would rest. Does that answer your question?
Yes, that answers the question. Thank you. And may I ask another question?
You can ask another question.
Okay. Is there something written into the Constitution that is deceptive wording that would give the Supreme Court absolute power over the land?
In fact, the beauty of the Constitution was the checks and balances, and basically the Congress could thwart the Supreme Court anytime it wanted to. And just exactly as the executive could do things, but of course the Congress could limit what the executive did, and if he got out of line, they could impeach him. Mm-hmm. And Congress has the ability to impeach the members of the Supreme Court. So the beauty of this was it was all checks and balances. One part of government could restrict the other. No government would have supreme, but no branch of government, either the executive or judicial or legislative, would have supreme power. Now, of course, there is no reason why the Supreme Court should be getting away with what it's doing,
right,
other than our congressmen are afraid to take a stand, and we haven't made them realize that if they don't take a stand, we're going to get rid of them. So it was Everett Dirksen who said, congressmen or legislators don't see the light until they feel the heat, so we need to begin warming up the heat for them.
That's right, and the structure is set up very clearly, and you can see how it's been destroyed by the confirmation process for a Supreme Court justice is now the controlling issue, and what the Senate is really about. And nothing else they really do ultimately will make a difference, but who they allow through their checking gate to become a Supreme Court justice is, as they recognize clearly, their most important power. And the Constitution was never designed to do that. They were just advice and consent. It was not the whole process of controlling the federal judiciary, because they recognize the federal judiciary today is the real power that runs our country and controls legislation.
And of course, if they can destroy the religious foundation of this nation, they can destroy the nation, and that's exactly what they're up to. And you've got to help us get the truth out, Karen.
Yes, I will. Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. Well, our telephone number again is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. And, of course, here in the out across the nation, find me here in the Central Coast of California, 464-8295. So it's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. Judicial activism is judicial tyranny, and you go back and you read Thomas Jefferson's remarks about, I see in the federal judiciary the seeds of destruction of our Constitution for, you know, anybody working as a thief by night, taking a little here, a little there, until eventually all powers will be centralized in Washington, D.C., and we shall have a government as tyrannical as that from which we've recently separated ourselves.
And he could little envision what we have today, I'm sure, where we have a government more tyrannical than what they liberated themselves from under King George III.
Yeah.
Well, we were talking about the ratification debates, and the anti-federalist has some very excellent arguments, but ultimately their position was overcome. The Bill of Rights was a big part of that, and the Federalists won the day in terms of arguing that there was a need for something to replace the Articles of Confederation, and that federalism is simply the sharing of power between federal and state governments. And the way they designed it in the Constitution, as we'll go on to study in the months ahead, there was a balance, there was a check and balance process that would prevent the kind of tyranny that we have experienced. But because the people are ignorant of the Constitution and they don't know the nuts and bolts and don't know how it works and don't know how they are supposed to keep a check upon all elected officials to see that they do uphold their constitutional oath to uphold the Constitution, because the people are not functioning in the role that they're designed to function by our founding fathers. The whole tyrant, the group of tyrants has been able to take over our nation and strip us increasingly of our freedoms and liberties.
And this, of course, did not happen by accident. One of the most important books, I have about five or six most important books in my library, and one of them is a book called Foundations, Their Power and Influence. It was written by the Council for the only congressional committee ever allowed to investigate the great tax-exempt foundations. And this was back in 1953 and 1954, 50 years ago. And yet, of course, the book is so important today, because the Reese Committee, which investigated the tax-exempt foundations, found that the Rockefeller and Ford and Carnegie foundations were rewriting our textbooks, were rewriting our encyclopedias, and everything was aimed at this totalitarian society in the Encyclopedia Britannica. Why, the part on socialism would be written by a socialist, and the part on communism would be written by a communist, and the part on capitalism and free enterprise would be written by a communist. And everything was slanted. And so they gradually took away this understanding of the past. And, of course, as George Santayana had said so well, those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it, and the past is simply one episode of tyranny after another imposed upon the people, and people ground down, by the brutal heel of serfdom and tyranny. So we have to understand what we had. We have to reclaim our Constitution. Let's once again get that telephone number out and how they can get in touch with you, and the website, David?
Yes, if they want to call us to order a host kit, our number is 1-886-730-9796. That's 1-886-730-9796. Or they can go to our website, iotconline.com. That's iotconline.com. Dr. Stan, I want to encourage your listeners, they don't need to be an expert, they don't need to be a historian, they don't need to be a lawyer. Actually, it's probably an advantage if they are not a lawyer, because the lawyers I've talked to said they have to unlearn what they were taught in law school in order to really understand the Constitution. Because what they were taught in law school is how to evade the Constitution, how to undermine the Constitution, how to completely ignore the Constitution and do it supposedly legally. That's what they were taught, not what the Constitution meant, not what our founding fathers' original intent was. They don't teach them that in law school. So a lawyer's got a difficult job of unlearning what he's been propagandized to believe the Constitution is really about. But anyone can do this. And Dr. Stan, if we had a million Americans who would take this host kit and gather a group of their friends, a group of their people at church, we have a number of churches that have hosted this recently and been very encouraged. It was a couple of churches in California that we graduated classes from last month, very encouraging, as they reached out to their community and said, we want to teach our community about God's principles of law and government. Imagine that. That's what churches used to do. As a matter of fact, that's why we had a war for independence, because King George knew that his greatest and most feared foes in America were the preachers of America, because they were preaching what God's Word teaches about law, what God's Word teaches about government, and they were basically saying King George is an unfit ruler according to the Bible, because the law of God says this and King George is doing that. They said that in their sermons. And so it was the preachers in the land that brought about a change in heart where people were willing to stand up to a tyrant. And we need that again today. So not only churches, but people can do it in their home, just gathering a group of people together. Or I know I'm going to be speaking next month to a Rotary Club up in Frederick, because those people are concerned. They see what's happening, and they need to know, how can we change the direction of our country? How can we restore the republic that has been lost to us? So all kinds of various groups of people all over our country, if they were to take this host kit and they were to conduct the class, they would begin to educate their fellow citizens. And an army of educated citizens, Dr. Stan, can turn this nation around.
Amen to that. Well, we're going to have to let you go, David. Our guest is
great to be with you,
Pastor David Whitney. And once again, we'll look forward to seeing you back next month as we explore more of the history of our magnificent Constitution.
God bless you.
And God bless you too, David. Bye-bye. Okay, well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course, this is the time when I have to remind our audience that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported, and we're dependent upon those of you out there across America who are hearing this program, who believe that there is a problem, and would be willing to stand
and
help us as we educate people about what's going on, and understanding that there really are dark and sinister spiritual forces working behind the scenes. Why? Because America was a Christian country. Everybody knew it was a Christian country. And there are satanic secret societies in our society today. And there are many of them. There's not simply one. There are many of them. And whether we talk about the Council on Foreign Relations, which is founded in the occult as a front for a secret society that was created back in 1891. And this is all covered in my book, Brotherhood of Darkness. And we have the documentation, much of it written by people who were part of the secret society or who had studied this or had the opportunity going through the secret records of the secret society. And I'm speaking of Professor Carol Quigley, who was Bill Clinton's mentor. And he talks on page 950 of his long-suppressed book, Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time, which we do carry now, although it was out of print for many years. But on page 950 of Tragedy and Hope, he talks about having the opportunity of going through the secret records of these secret societies. The information is there, but you're not going to hear about it from ABC, CBS, NBC, or Rush Limbaugh, or many of the others, because there is a conscious effort to conceal the truth from the American people. And if you don't believe it, why, the CIA actually pays journalists to suppress information. And if you doubt that, you need to read the book by General William Odom. 4-star general, he's with the Hudson Institute today. Formerly, he was head of the NSA, the super secret government agency. He can't come out and tell you that the CIA employs journalists. He just asks questions. Should the CIA be employing journalists in the media? Should the Defense Department be collecting dossiers on the people? Should the CIA be assassinating people? That's how he's able to impart the information that, of course, he's sworn not to reveal. You have to understand, ladies and gentlemen, this is very, very real. And the fact you haven't heard of it simply is a reflection of the degree of control that exists today over what American people think. So if you want to learn more about what's going on, go to our website at radioliberty.com, where you can hear our programs 5 hours a day. If you'd like a free copy of our newsletter, our number 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Please pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for our leaders and ministers. But please remember to pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection, because we're on the front lines of this truly spiritual battle for the hearts and minds and souls of our people. And so until tomorrow, we'll be back with you once again. This is Dr. Stan saying good night to those of you who are leaving us, and may the Lord be with you. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here on the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being. We have with us on the line Bill Dumas, and we're going to be talking about the men we abandoned, the boys we left behind. What most people don't understand is that there are wicked and evil people at the highest levels of our government. Working within the intelligence agencies are able to suppress information, working within the media, so that the average American really doesn't understand the history of what's happened. And the betrayal of American prisoners of war, American boys, who went overseas to fight for freedom in the First World War, and the Second World War, and the Korean War, and the Vietnamese War. And it's always covered up with lies and deception. There were over between 20 and 25,000 American boys were abandoned there during the Second World War. And General Eisenhower knew about it, and the people in positions of power knew about it. And then with Korea came, General Eisenhower knew we abandoned 8,000 American boys to be tortured, many of them tortured to death by our enemies. And we did absolutely nothing about that. And how many thousand, probably several thousand, were abandoned in Vietnam, not only in Vietnam, but people we had in Laos as well. We see they have to cover this up, because if the American people understood that, would you want to send your boys overseas to fight in another contrived war like all these others have been, and then abandoned? Oh, we're told American soldiers don't leave their wounded or their dead behind. That's true. The American soldiers don't. But your government does. Well, Bill, how did you get involved in this? I know that you've been putting a lot of effort into putting together a video, and you've done a lot of interviews, and we want to talk about some of those. But how did you get interested in trying to get the truth out to the American people, the truth that's been suppressed for so long?
Well, Dr. Stan, hi. I really enjoy being on your show here. I got involved probably in the mid-1970s, late 1970s, when I was in journalism school. And I tried to expose the story through an article in the school magazine. And had a difficult time doing it because no one wanted to believe that this happened. And my story focuses on the Korean War, because my uncle Bob Dumas has been looking for his brother Roger for 54 years now. And since I was exposed to his story at a very early age, my career path has kind of given me opportunities to try to expose the story through my journalism background. And again, in my film background, I was a fellow at the American Film Institute and was trying to sell the story in the early 90s to Oliver Stone's company, who was actually very interested in the story. But they decided that Oliver Stone had just come out with the movie JFK, and really received a lot of criticism for the point of view he took in the film, and decided that he didn't want to do another political story like that for a while. So they decided not to do the story of the Korean War POWs. But I then decided to try, rather than sell the documentary, rather the feature film, I tried to produce a documentary about the story. And I started about 3 years ago working on this film. And initially I was doing it more from a human interest point of view, about my uncle Bob trying to find his brother and what he's gone through in the past 54 years, and what the government's done to him, and what he had to do to take the government to federal courts in order to even for the government to admit his brother was even a POW, which they were denying all those years.
And they knew he was a POW. They knew exactly where he is. This is the tragedy. They've known about this all along, but they've just lied to the American people and lied and lied and lied. And they've even had all sorts of congressional and Senate hearings, and I know you had an opportunity to interview Senator Bob Smith. He was an honest senator, and of course you know what they did to him. They ran Sununu, who was a corrupt politician, who was actually tossed out of government during the first Bush administration for using a government helicopter to go to his golf tournaments. But so they ran him against Bob Smith and got rid of him out of, I think he was from Maine. So they will go to any length to get rid of responsible people. And you're not supposed to go against a sitting Republican senator, but of course the administration did that. They wanted to get rid of an honest man. So they'll go to any lengths at all to deceive and to keep this information from the public, won't they?
Oh, absolutely. And losing Senator Smith was a big blow to the POW/MIA cause. And that was a terrific interview. He did the longest interview I did of all the people I interviewed. We did over 4-hour interview, and the information he was giving me was really unbelievable.
Now, of course, he had sat through these long, interminable hearings, so he was well aware of the actual information that was there. And then, of course, it was suppressed from the American people. So why don't you go ahead and could you want to tell us a little bit about what you learned from Senator Smith about the boys we betrayed?
Well, what was interesting is that Senator Smith, I believe he did not miss any hearings whatsoever during that entire Senate Select Committee hearings in 92, 91, 92. And interestingly, when they got on the subject of the Korean War, by the afternoon of that session, when a lot of information was coming out, Senator Smith was the only senator on the dais at that time. All the other senators had left, and right after that, they only gave one day to the Korean War, and then they never listened to any more testimony about the Korean War. But Senator Smith really put the issue on the table. I think he upset Senators Kerry and McCain, who were just trying to get this issue out of the way so we could normalize relations with Vietnam.
And of course, Senator Kerry really was doing everything he could to conceal the truth. And Senator John McCain, well, I'll tell you, the veterans, POWs, hate McCain because he went over to the other side and went right along with the communists who were torturing them. He was called the prince, and he had very, very special treatment. In fact, we have pictures of him hugging the communist who tortured so many of our citizens. So go ahead and tell the story.
Well, in fact, specifically about McCain, I did get a lot of information from Congressman Bob Dornan about that, and also from a Senate investigator who I interviewed, who talked about when I screen the rough cut of this documentary to audiences, they say, well, why would McCain be against finding out what happened to the POWs? And it appears that it's really his POW record that he does not want to be made public. And in fact, what had happened, apparently he had done about 30 or so propaganda broadcasts for the North Vietnamese propaganda machine while he was a POW.
Well, Bill, you got great information, and I want to get this out, but we've got a real bad line with a hum on it. I'm going to ask if you'll hang up, and I'll have our producer call you right back again.
Okay, he calls
you before, didn't he?
Yes, he did.
All right, fine. So I'm going to ask Rob if he'll go ahead, Rod, if he'll just go ahead and call you right back, because I want to get this information out. Okay, fine. Well, our guest this evening is Bill Dumas, and Bill certainly has been doing a yeoman's job of getting the information together and accumulating it, getting it on film, and he's producing a documentary film. I mean, are you concerned that we abandoned several thousand boys in Vietnam? Some of them were taken off to Russia for horrible experiments, medical experiments. Some of them were tortured to death. And the government officials knew this, and of course the CIA knew this, and they suppressed the information. Are you concerned that the same thing happened to 8,000 boys after the Korean War? And the government officials knew this, and General Eisenhower knew this, and but the information has been suppressed because they can't let the American people realize that they don't stand behind our boys. They betray them. And do you really want your son and daughter to go off and fight if this indeed is the case? Because we have wicked and evil people at the highest levels of government. Now, there's some wonderful people there, too. I remember General Tai, who was in charge of the Defense Intelligence Agency, trying to get this information out, and Colonel Peck, who headed that unit for a time and was so disturbed that he finally just took his resignation and stabbed into the door of his office and walked out and left his entire military career because he could not be part of such a cover-up and betrayal of the men he fought with. And he felt a strong feeling of obligation to them. But you see, you never hear about this from Rush Limbaugh, or Dan Rather, or Bill O'Reilly. Why? Because they're paid fabulous salaries not to reveal what's going on, but to conceal what's going on from the American people. And so it's really vitally important that you have the information and that you get this. And we have a wonderful book. It's called Betrayed. It's the story of what happened to the boys, well, really from the very, very beginning. We actually have a report that came out of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. We call it the Helms Committee Report. You can get it as part of it by itself or as part of our Vietnam special. And, of course, if you give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. You can order the Helms Committee Report, or maybe some of you would want to get the set Vietnam. And, of course, we go into one of the tape sets is The Men We Left Behind, interviews with people who've studied this for many years. Or we have One Man Came Back, the story of Bobby Garwood. And, of course, he was smart enough to be able to escape. And, of course, they didn't want him to come back. They wanted him to die. And he was told when he left Vietnam by his communist prisoners, you wish you'd never gone back. You wish you'd died here. And that's exactly what they did. He was persecuted and prosecuted by our government because they did not want the American people. And they made him to know the truth, and they made him out to be a traitor. And the traitors working within our government actually imprisoned this man, this heroic guy who was smart enough to survive. And he wasn't supposed to survive. None of them are supposed to survive. They're all supposed to die. So we're going to be back in just a moment here, and we've got Bill Dumas back on the line. Hi, Bill, are you there?
I'm here.
Okay, we've got a much better line. Go ahead.
One thing I did want to say about Senator Smith is that he said in the interview that that representatives from DPMO, which is the Defense Department's POW/MIA office, when they came and they testified before the Senate panel, he said they outright lied, and he said what they did, there are individuals that should have gone to jail for lying to the Senate Select Committee. But he said nothing was ever done to prosecute them. He said that if that had happened in any other issue, they would have been prosecuted. But because of the POW/MIA issue, nothing was said about it. And he even named names in the interview.
Now, when we but can you tell us about what you learned from Senator Smith about what had happened, in Korea, and the number of boys we left behind, and what happened to those boys?
Well, what happened in Korea? The UN command allowed, well over 20,000 POWs it was holding, North Korean and Chinese POWs, to defect to South Korea and to Formosa, which is now Taiwan. And because of that very much angered the North Korean government. And because in their view, we did not give them back all their POWs. So they said, fine, we're going to keep some of your POWs.
But of course, these people didn't want to go back. These people hated communism. And of course, a lot of those people got away, not because of any generosity on our part, but because Syngman Rhee, the president of South Korea, opened the prison gates to allow these people to escape so that our government would not send them back.
Exactly. That's exactly what happened. At the same time, the North Korean military that was holding the POWs, they were classifying all the American POWs, and they put them into three categories. One category was Americans that they thought they could convert to communism, and the second category was POWs, American POWs who had technical skills that would help train their technicians into the high-tech world. And then the rest of the POWs were those that they really didn't have any use for. And then they pretty much stated in policy that they would not release the POWs that fell in the first two categories. And when the war ended, they did hold those POWs back.
And there were about 8,000 of them.
Yes. And Colonel Corso, Philip Corso, who testified before the Senate panel, he was the POW liaison for President Eisenhower, and he stated in the hearings that there was a meeting between his superior and the president, the three of them, and he gave a report to this President Eisenhower that POWs were held back by the North Koreans and 1,200. Or 900 for sure, but he felt at least 1,200 were sent to the Soviet Union.
In other words, they were sent to Soviet Union for experimentation, and that's covered in the book Betrayed that we have by Joe Douglas, so go ahead.
Yes, and...
And we knew about that. We didn't care. That was the
right.
Horrible thing, because all during that time we were still finding one or another excuse to send money to Russia to keep their socialist system from failing totally.
Correct, and also, at that time there was and Colonel Corso also talks about the a policy, an official U.S. government policy called a fig leaf policy, which would not allow any criticism of the American government towards the Soviet Union, towards China.
Well, of course, no, they were just our good friends. And
right.
No, we weren't supposed to talk about the fact that Russia had killed 60 million people, consolidating power, and China had probably killed 60 to 80 million. Oh, no, no, we're not supposed to be critical of these people at all. After all, they were our friends. And the tragedy is the American people were never allowed to realize how evil, how brutal, how tyrannical. I mean, all we hear is the 6 million people that Adolf Hitler killed in the concentration camps. Actually, it was much more than that. There were 12 million Christians that he killed, too, but we never mention those. But we never talk about the 60 million that Stalin killed. Because, of course, would be just too horrible for the American people. Maybe we would wonder why our government, under one guise or another, is constantly finding another vehicle of giving massive loans or transferring technology or unilaterally disarming, as we're doing today, in the face of such a brutal and tyrannical regime. Why we honor and fet the former dictator of Russia, Gorbachev, why he can get offices in the Presidio, and you and I couldn't get offices in the Presidio, why he worked so closely with multi-billionaires like Maurice Strong and Stephen Rockefeller, who is probably will lead the Rockefeller clan when David Rockefeller goes to his just reward very soon, I suspect. So anyway, they knew that there had been 800 to 1,200 sent to the Soviet Union. Eisenhower knew that, and he wasn't concerned.
Yeah, Eisenhower knew that, and Colonel Corso basically told him it would be very difficult to get those POWs back. Eisenhower asked for a recommendation, and actually it was Colonel Corso who recommended leaving them behind. Because you got to remember that for over half the war, the one final stalemate that was preventing the war from ending was the issue of the exchange of POWs.
And so they really weren't worried about them. They were quite willing to sacrifice them, let them die as slaves, or
exactly.
Be killed or tortured to death. because it would be politically expedient.
Right.
What sort of human beings are these? Well, I think they're rather tragic human beings. I think it represents the evil that is such a prevalent part of what takes place in Washington, D.C. today. We'll be right back here in just a moment or two with our special guest, Bill Dumas. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Bill Dumas. Bill, now, did Colonel Corso, did he ever talk about the degree of control over the media here in the United States and why these stories didn't get out?
Well, unfortunately, Colonel Corso passed away shortly after he testified before the Dornan hearings in 1996. He was one person I was really hoping I could interview. And a funny thing was is that I did do an interview with a Pentagon analyst, a DIA analyst, who said that they had debriefed Colonel Corso in a hotel room at one point, and they had a videotape of that. He offered to let me have that videotape, which very very much surprised me. When he sent me the videotape, just as Colonel Corso began speaking, the tape just went blank. And so I called the DIA officer, and I said, this tape is blank. So he said, oh, it must have been a mistake in duplicating it. Send it back. I'll send you another one. He sent me another one, and it was the same thing. And I called him back, and he checked the original, and the original had nothing on it.
It's sort of like those that the 14 minutes of the Nixon tapes. They just sort of mysteriously disappeared.
Yes, exactly. Well, now, what I understand is that after the Dornan hearing, when he testified, he was at a press conference, and he stated at the press conference that after the war, that the media was told not to report about the POWs being left behind.
Did he have any sense of guilt? Did he spiel of what they'd done was morally wrong?
I think he didn't. I think that's why he testified. And in fact, in the 92 hearings, the Senate Select hearings, he said I've been living with this knowledge for over 40 years, and I need to let it out to make it public. I think he felt some tremendous guilt for that.
Well, this is the great tragedy, and of course, after the hearings, it never got out because they suppressed his information as well.
Yeah, and it was interesting that in 92, after his hearings, there wasn't even a mention of it in the media. But it wasn't until when he testified, he basically gave the same testimony in 96 before Dornan's hearings. Now he basically gave the same testimony about the abandoning of POWs. Eisenhower knew about all this, but it somehow made the news, and I think it was because, and according to Al Santoli, who was Bob Dornan's chief of staff, in an interview he told me that because they backed up the information that Corso had testified to with documents that they managed to declassify from the Eisenhower Library. So they had all the documents to back up what he had said. Now, the Senate Select Committee in 92 wasn't interested. They didn't even want to hear what he had to say, and they certainly weren't going to go out of their way to try to back it up with documents.
Now, was that Senate Select Committee the Kerry Committee?
Yes, the Kerry Committee.
And I think you have to understand, ladies and gentlemen, that John Kerry did everything he could to make sure those boys would never come home and the American people would never know about them. He's a man who's totally without a social conscience. He comes from a secret occult society, but then so does our current president. They both are members of Skull and Bones, and they've sworn, and their oaths are so secret that they cannot reveal them. Now, I would think that if you are a Christian, you would not be swearing oaths to a secret society, and I'm very concerned about Senator Kerry and the fact that he covered up the fate of the men we left behind. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Bill Dumas. We're talking about the men we abandoned and left behind. And so, basically, of course, Philip Corso, Colonel Corso, did come forward and eventually admit that not only did they suppress the information, as far as the American people, but they got their media not to let this information out either. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. I don't exactly know how they did that. I, from secondhand information, I was told that that the government paid the media not to report on it. I don't know if that's true, but that's secondhand information.
Well, of course, I will tell you very well that the CIA hires people, journalists in the media, to suppress information. And we have that on very, very top levels. Certainly, William Odom talked about that in his book, Fixing Intelligence. Should the CIA have journalists planted in the media? And, of course, it's been going on for a long time. We've got some of the finest reporters that money can buy in the media today, suppressing information from the public.
Well, I know that there certainly continues to be a very strong effort to suppress this story in the media. We had a producer at CBS News who was very interested in the story and wanted to do this story for quite a while, for a few years, and she was working for 48 hours. And what I had heard happened when she was really pushing hard to get this story produced by the CBS News, Dan Rather told her, "We are not ever going to do this story." And 3 weeks later, she was gone. She had left CBS News, and we've never been able to contact her again. And she'd always stayed in very close contact just to find out, you know, any new developments in the story, what was going on. But we never heard another word from her after that.
What, do you happen to have her name offhand?
Her name is Linda Kim.
All right, Linda Kim. So there are good people in the media who try to get stories out. We have a book written called Into the Buzzsaw by a woman who actually was a producer for CBS, tried to get the true story of TWA 800 out.
Yes.
Why, of course, she lost her job there, went to work for ABC, lost her job there. She can't get a job anywhere in the media. She's been blacklisted. Why? She wants to tell the truth. Same thing happened to Monica Jensen Stevenson, who did a program for CBS on the boys we abandoned in Vietnam, and, of course, can never get another job working in the media. And not only that, but their publisher would not circulate her book, Kiss the Boys Goodbye. She got the plates back, went up to Canada. It was reprinted up there, and then they just accidentally shredded 5,000 copies of the book. Monica thinks it was just an accident. I'll have to admit I'm just a little bit more suspicious than Monica is, although she's a lovely woman and certainly a brilliant reporter and did a wonderful job in her book. The first one was Kiss the Boys Goodbye. The second one was Spite House. So anyway, now what else did you actually learn from Senator Smith?
Well, he was speaking of Into the Buzzsaw. Senator Smith told me a very interesting story. If you have him on the show, you definitely should ask him about this. He was in Vietnam with Bobby Darwood. And apparently, Bobby Garwood was held in a certain area. I believe it was an island on this big lake. And Senator Smith was doing some investigation and asked the intelligence community for background on this information. He wanted to know about this. This location that Bobby Garwood was speaking about, and they basically said, "No, that doesn't exist. No, there's no lake there. There's certainly no island there. That's all wrong information." But when he actually went over there, he just found a local who drove him, you know, for a couple of hours out to this place. Said, "Oh yeah, there's a lake and there's an island," and everything that Bobby Garwood had described to him to a T, Senator Smith had found out there.
There's somebody, those men are still alive, but I mean, I'm sure you know why the North Vietnamese wouldn't give them back. I mean, because we would not give them the money that Henry Kissinger promised them.
Right.
And so Henry Kissinger simply lied to the American people and said they're all back, knowing full well that they were not all back. But of course, we couldn't tell the American people the truth. And this is the tragedy of everything going on today. You can't tell the people the truth about why the North Vietnamese wouldn't give our troops back, or the truth about why the North Koreans wouldn't give our troops back, or why we really went to war in Vietnam, or why we went to war in Iraq. So everything is lies and deception. And the tragedy is, how can you have a free society when you have an elite who are able to control the media, who are able to control both political parties, were able to control what the American people think. We'll be back here in just a moment with Bill DeMar here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Bill DeMar, and of course he's a... Do you call it DeMar or DeMoss?
I pronounce it DeMar.
Okay, DeMar.
Actually, everybody else in my family, including my Uncle Bob, says Dumas, but I go to the traditional French. Being a writer, I think in a French pronunciation.
Well, I like the French pronunciation, too. Anyway, why don't you go right ahead and tell us a little bit more about what you've learned.
Another interesting thing Senator Smith told me during the Senate Select hearings on how the government would try to discredit witnesses who had information about live POWs, in this case Vietnam, was that they would take satellite photos, and rather than and they would show like an inverse view of them, so that the witness would say, would describe the village, and they say, okay, you go down this street on the village, and you make a left-hand turn, and because the photo was inverted, there would only be a right-hand turn, and so all the directions would be backwards. So if the witness is trying to explain the layout of the village, it doesn't sound right, because the image they're viewing in the hearing room is a inverted image.
And they knew what they were doing. They were, I can remember reading the testimony when General Tai was there, and he was trying to get the information out. So they would ask him three questions at the same time. Now, this is, you ordinarily ask one question, you answer it, you ask the second question. So they'd ask him three questions at once, so his mind's got to be focusing on three separate things at the same time in an effort to confuse him. It's a standard technique that is done to confuse the witness when you don't want the information out there.
Right. Another thing, a little bit off the subject, but not really, is that I got a call from Ross Perot a while back, and I had sent him a two-hour rough cut of the documentary, and he was very excited about it, and he said, "Wow, this is really amazing. You did this, and everything you're saying, your witnesses are saying here, your interviewees, it's all true information." He then was telling me about a story where he met with President Reagan in the Oval Office and told the president that that there was very credible evidence of POWs still being alive in Vietnam and Korea. The president said, "Well, if you can put together a report for me and bring it back, you know, I'll put a couple people in to investigate this." It was quite a while before he went back. It was near the end of the president's term, his second term, and he said that the president was already suffering the early effects of Alzheimer's at that time.
Hold that thought. Well, get back here. Our guest is Bill DeMar, and I'll ask Ed, who's calling from Aptos, to hang on just a moment more. He's telling us a story about Ross Perot, the story of Ross Perot told him. Ross Perot had been to see President Reagan, told him about the boys that were over there, credible evidence, and the president told him to go back and prepare a report and bring it to him. So he prepares a report. He goes back to see President Reagan towards the end of his time in office, and he's apparently already beginning to have some of the signs of Alzheimer's disease. So pick up the story there.
So at that point, it's mostly the President Reagan staff that's doing most of the talking, and they made it very clear to him that that they were not going to pursue this idea that there are live POWs. And the interesting thing is that at that time, the national security advisor for President Reagan was Admiral James Bud Nance. Nance is the guy that comes along in 1991 and fires the staff, Jesse Helms' staff, who was investigating the POW issue. And it was the report, the minority report on POW MIAs.
We offered that incidentally to our ministry.
Uh-huh. Yes, it's an amazing report. And the staff who put that report together was all fired by Admiral James Budd Nance.
Well, now, how could he fire Helms' staff? Did Helms just go along with him and let him do it?
Well, at the time of the Bush administration, it was Brent Scowcroft was the National Security Advisor. He pretty much told Jesse Helms that this issue had to die and his people had to go, and he basically sent Budd Nance to do that job.
That's when Jim Lucero lost his job. Then
exactly, okay. Budd Nance came in and became chief of staff for Jesse Helms, and Jim Lucero, who had been best friends with Jesse Helms for 26 years. All he got was a letter from Jesse Helms saying that his services were no longer required. Now, he asked Senator Helms why he was doing this, and the only thing Senator Helms said was it was for national security reasons, which in the interview I did with Jim Lesore, he said, which I found most interesting. Now, I also interviewed the chief investigator on that minority staff, who was Tracy Ussery, and he said that when they were all fired, they were just brought into a room. Jesse Helms spoke to them through a speakerphone, didn't allow them to ask any questions. He said, "I'm doing this for the good of the nation."
Right, and the good of the nation is to lie to the American people. Let's go to Ed calling from Aptos. Hi, Ed. How are you doing? You have a question or comment?
Brief question. What was that? Could you refresh my memory? Thank you for having the guest, by the way. Could you refresh my memory what Henry Kissinger said about soldiers?
Oh, he said they are stupid, dumb animals to be used for foreign policy purposes. The quotation comes from page 194 of the book, The Final Days by Woodward and Bernstein. That's now The Final Days of Woodward and Bernstein's book. Final Days are the title, Woodward and Bernstein, page 194. The military are stupid, dumb animals to be used for foreign policy.
Thank you, Dr. Stan.
Thanks very much.
Interesting. Another thing he said about rescuing POWs, he said, what do you want us to do, create more POWs by rescuing POWs?
Right, because, you know, these are all sophisticated approaches to it. I mean, the logic, you know, tells you that you don't abandon your men. If you believe in your country, I remember when Teddy Roosevelt sent a whole military contingent over to, I think it was Tripoli, to rescue one woman. That's the story of the Lion of the Wind, I think it is, with Sean Connery. It's a wonderful story, but, you know, you do not rescue, you do not kidnap Americans. There was something special about being an American. Well, today, of course, we have people, wicked people in government who abandon thousands of American fighting men who went overseas to fight for freedom, not realizing that we weren't fighting for freedom. Our leaders had a far different agenda. So, you know, this must have been very discouraging for Jim Lucere. What was his take on it? Did he realize that that the whole idea was to discourage this so those men would die and never be an embarrassment to Henry Kissinger and the other people who betrayed them?
Well, yeah, I think that's the issue. You know, people say, "Well, this happened so long ago," but the fact is, a lot of people who are still in power today, who are involved in government, who are in the bureaucracy, they were around. If they weren't part of the decision to leave the POWs behind, they're certainly part of the effort to keep it from the American public and keep it quiet, because they certainly do not want that information to be made public.
But there's still some of the, I know the Koreans are, some of them are still escaping. They were taken captive during the Korean War. The French, at least the government, whatever you may think about the French, at least they stand by their soldiers, and they're still negotiating and still getting people out of Vietnam. America won't negotiate, won't do anything. They just want them to die.
Right. We do not negotiate. You know, my Uncle Bob always used to say that. He would say, not once in the history of this nation have we ever negotiated for one POW. And I said, well, you know, that's ridiculous. But, you know, as I look into this, you know, there's truth to that. I mean, sure, we negotiate while the conflict is going on. While the Korean War was still active, we were negotiating. But once that war was over, once we knew we left those POWs behind, that was the end of the negotiation.
But you see, the North Koreans were desperate for food. They were desperate for help. I mean, they would have given them back if but we didn't want them back. And the same thing is true with the North Vietnamese. They've offered to give them back, and they've been told, we don't want you to talk about that. We want to give you recognition. We want to give you foreign aid. We don't want our prisoners back. That is what's so unconscionable.
That's also absolutely true, and it's so hard to try to get this story out, because it just seems so unbelievable, but it is just the absolute truth. And that's why I'm doing this film, because I'm trying to, I think the only way anything will ever be done with this issue of getting POWs back, who are, I'm certain, still alive in North Korea and definitely in Vietnam, is if it becomes an issue with the American public. I mean, it has to be an issue that shows up on the polls before the government will do anything about it at all.
Well, now, of course, as we get into the background of this whole thing, and as you talk to these people, is Ross Perot still interested in this issue? Is he willing to help you at all?
Well, you know, Ross has called me about three times in the past few months to talk about this issue. He's been just giving me information on his experience and some advice on who I should interview. I initially was contacting him to get a donation, asking him for a donation, because I'm doing the film through a nonprofit organization, so any money that's donated is a tax-deductible donation. So I was basically only asking him for a $15,000 donation to finish the post-production on the film. And when he called, in fact, when he did call me, he called four times. He was just that in a hurry to get in touch with me. I thought for sure that he was going to donate financially to the project, and he hasn't. And the last time I spoke with him, he gave me some more information. He said, "Well, that's really all I can do to help you." Now, when I had a meeting in Washington about a month ago with a former Senate staffer, he told me, he says, "You know, Ross is not going to put his name or get involved in anything having to do with POWs anymore, because he was threatened with a loss of government contracts if he continued pursuing the POW-MIA issue." And I thought, you know, this sounds a little far-fetched to me, but the last two times I talked to Ross, it was clear that he did not. I even asked him in a letter if I could just use his endorsement, and he just avoided that whole issue altogether. Right now I have a flyer where I do quote him what he said about the documentary, but I didn't get his permission to do that, and I was surprised. I said, and I gave him you know a few options that I hoped he would take, one being to, you know, to donate this money. He actually, when I first talked to him, talked about loaning me the money, as opposed to just donating the money. He offered he talked about loaning me the money. I would certainly accept a loan, but then he reneged on that apparently. And but then the next letter, I said, "Well, can I use you as an endorsement?" And he didn't respond to that either. And so suddenly it became a little more feasible that maybe what this Senate staffer is saying about the threatened loss of contracts, government contracts, is true. But you know, Ross has been a big supporter of this issue, and a big supporter of veterans in general. And it's just hard for me to grasp that he would take that stand.
Well, I know one time, certainly during the early years of the Reagan administration, he helped to act as a conduit for money that was given to Colonel Bill Greitz, who went in, supposedly as an independent, but it was really, of course, simply sheep-dipped and being used as a CIA operative to go in into Vietnam. But he didn't realize he wasn't supposed to go in to get the prisoners. He was supposed to be killed, and he outsmarted them, and they've never forgiven him for that. We have some wonderful interviews with Bo Greitz telling about that. But Ross Perot was very interested, very involved in that. That was during the early years of the Reagan administration, when Bo Greitz went into Vietnam, and then he went into the Golden Triangle and interviewed Khun Som. That's another fascinating story. I'm sure you're probably well aware of that part of the story.
And going back to that, around the time that Ross Perot was meeting with President Reagan, I understand from another source, and I haven't gotten the documents in my hands yet, but I'm looking for it. But this very, very credible source said that when there seemed to be credible evidence presented to Reagan that there were in fact live POWs in Vietnam, Colin Powell, who was head of Joint Chiefs of Staff at the time, sent a memo saying that can you imagine the cost if we come up with a live POW at this point would be, meaning political cost.
And political cost. In other words, the Colin Powell, a soldier who you would think would be concerned about the lives of other soldiers, was more interested in politics and political cost than he was in the life of a young man.
Yes, exactly.
A comrade in arms, you know. Colin Powell is a politician. You know, everybody tries to give him a good shake, but he really isn't. He's part of the Council on Foreign Relations complex. He covered up the Gulf War syndrome. You know, he has done everything to advance his political career, stepping over the bodies of the men he was quite willing to abandon.
Yes, that's a terrible legacy.
Well, anyway, let's. Any other things that you think would be important that you've learned from your film, talking to Ross Perot or talking to Senator Bob Smith or talking to the others, Jim Lucier?
I actually had a very interesting opportunity. A friend of mine is an immigration lawyer here in L.A., and one of his clients just moved here from South Korea, and he was a defector from North Korea, and his name is Kim Yong. He was a former lieutenant colonel in the North Korean intelligence service, and he was sent to a concentration camp because it was found out that his father collaborated with the CIA during the Korean War, and it is North Korean policy that if anybody is arrested for any crime whatsoever, that the entire family has to go to concentration camp, and not only the family, but three generations of the family. So he and his mother and everyone, his brother, they all had to go to the concentration camp. In 1996, he was working in a gulag, I believe he called it gulag number 14. They were working on a road detail, clearing a mudslide or something, and he saw seven Caucasian men. Working in an area by themselves. He spoke to a former North Korean general, army general, who was also in a concentration camp. He said, "Who are those guys over there?" He says, "Well, those are American POWs in the Korean War. And in fact, I've seen many other American and British POWs working in the various concentration camps." Now, he escaped. He was the only person to escape from that concentration camp. It was the highest security concentration camp in North Korea. He escaped in 1996 or 97. He saw these POWs in 96. Now, he escaped out of that camp and got into China and then finally into South Korea. And he was debriefed by South Korean intelligence agents. Now, the ironic thing is that no American intelligence agents were interested in interrogating him. And I was at a Pentagon meeting for the families of POW MIAs in the Korean War, and I asked the a Pentagon analyst, I said, why is it that Colonel Kim Yong was never interrogated by your office, at least, if not by the CIA and FBI? And he said, "Well, you know, he waffled on his debriefing. First, he said he didn't see any POWs. Then he said he saw three, and then he said he saw seven. So because of that, and of course, U.S. intelligence finds any reason to debunk any kind of eyewitness reports of live POWs in Vietnam and in North Korea. So that was all the evidence they needed not to bother even interrogating him. But I interviewed him, and he was very adamant about what he saw, and said that when he came to the United States, which is only in 2003, he came to the United States, and he tried to again speak with U.S. intelligence officials about these American POWs that he'd seen in 1996. and they just weren't interested. And there was an organization who sponsored a trip for him to New York and Washington, and they held a press conference, which I believe it was on C-SPAN. I talked to some people who actually saw him talking about this. And even after that, he still was not interrogated. As far as I know, he's never been interrogated. Now I'm having a difficult time finding him because he told me in the interview, he said there are ways to get information about who the Americans are in the POW, in these, not POW camps, but in the concentration camps in North Korea, and bribing the right person, you can even get photos. And he said we would have to meet in a more secure location, and we can talk the details about how to do that. And since then, my contact to him has not been able to find him. So that's when my film is finished, which will be very shortly. My next mission is to actually try to find some concrete ways to getting in contact in some way with these Americans that may still be in North Korea.
Does he speak English fairly well?
He does not speak English. I was speaking to him through a South Korean interpreter who's a minister here in L.A. who helps defectors from North Korea emigrate into the United States.
Well, the thing is that this is one of the greatest cover-ups of our time. If the American people could understand what's going on, if they could understand that we do not want those people to come back, the wicked people who are responsible for betraying them have done everything they could, and one of them, of course, is Henry Kissinger, going back to the Vietnamese War, has done everything to be sure that anybody who ever talked about this was discredited. In fact, I think it was your uncle who said that he was bringing a court case, and wasn't it Kissinger who actually tried to intervene with the judge to try to convince the judge to give an improper ruling just so that it would discredit or would prevent your your uncle from having his brother classified as a POW?
That's true. The lengths they went to try to stop that trial from happening is unbelievable. There are five POW witnesses who agreed to testify. See, the background in a nutshell was that my uncle Roger was missing in Korea and never heard from again. And my uncle Bob, for 25 years, finally put together a case that proved that he actually was a POW and the government knew about it, and the government said no, he was never be a POW. Now he had five witnesses who knew his brother in a POW camp, two of whom were with his brother when during Big Switch, when the POWs were being repatriated, and were there when Roger and many other POWs were being brought back into the compound and actually not released. All five of these POW witnesses were warned by FBI and intelligence agents not to testify in court, that they took an oath of silence when they were released from the POW camp, not to talk about their experiences in the POW camp. And they said they could not talk about this, and they all refused. And it's his top, his main ex-POW witness was warned a second time by the FBI, and then about a few weeks before the court trial, he died of a heart attack. And his wife said, you know, he had no heart problems. There's no way he could just die of a heart attack. And another witness also died of a heart attack just before the court trial, and two other witnesses became so ill they couldn't even travel to the trial in Hartford. And finally, the one witness who testified in court, who I did interview, who lives, his name is Lloyd Pate, from the 24th Division. He lives in Georgia now. He said that while he was sequestered in the waiting room waiting to testify, that he was approached by an Army captain. And the Army captain brought up the fact that his mother in her youth, I believe, had been a prostitute. She had a very shady past, apparently, in her youth. And he said that if he were to testify, that information could be made public. And Lloyd Pate said, well, you know, my mother has passed away, and if that information, you can't harm her with it. And And it's not going to hurt me if you make that public. And besides, the point is the truth needs to come out here. And what's wrong with presenting the truth in this case?
And what did the captain say?
You know, the captain said nothing to that. He just walked out of the room.
And, of course, ladies and gentlemen, what's so tragic is they're threatening people in America to keep the truth from coming out, because this is one of the most important stories there is, and we're going to keep hammering away at it as long as God gives us breath. Bill, thank you so much for being with us, and we're going to look forward to having you on our other programs and working with you. And we want to keep this issue alive before the American people.
That'd be great. Hey, can I give you the website for the...
Sure, you go right ahead and put out a pitch for people to help you financially if you want to.
Yeah, the website for the documentary film about the abandoned POWs is www.eaglecried.com. And there's information. There's a 6-minute trailer, video preview that you can download and look at. And there's also information on making a tax-deductible donation to the film, and in doing so, have your name in the credits as being a sponsor of the film as well.
All right. Well, God bless you. Thank you so very much for what you're doing, and we'll be talking to you later.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Stanton. I really appreciate it.
Good night.
Opportunity. Night.
Okay, fine. Well, ladies and gentlemen, this is an amazing, amazing story. The trouble is that most Americans have no idea what's really going on in the world because your news is filtered. You're not getting the truth. You read the European press or you go to the Internet, you can find the stories that you'll never see covered here. So help us to get the information out. We hope many of you will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters, because that's how we're able to do what we do. 5 hours every day, 35 different stations on the weekend. Quite frankly, we need your help to do what we're doing. If you believe there's a problem, if you believe, as I do, we're involved in a spiritual battle for the hearts and souls of men, then seriously consider joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters. Our number, 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. If you'd like a free newsletter, why, of course, we'd be glad to get one for you. You need to read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness. That's the Brotherhood of Darkness. You need to get Joe Douglas's wonderful book, Betrayed. You need to get our 4-tape set, The Men We Left Behind. And then One Man Came Back. You can get it by itself or as part of the Vietnam Special. You can get that report from the Senate Minority Committee of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, the report that's been effectively suppressed. Why? Why, of course, everybody likes Ike, good old Eisenhower. You wouldn't like him so much when you knew that the abandoned 20 to 25,000 Americans to die in the gulag. And in 1991, when Yeltsin wanted to even give the boys back, why, he was told not to talk about that. You know, if you want any help from America, we don't want those boys back. And you have to understand, Ike knew the same thing about the Korean War, and he abandoned those boys as well. And Nixon knew what he had done. He even told one of the naval commanders who went to see him, you know, Red Daniels, I think was his name, that he felt terrible about that, but see, there was just nothing he could do. He meant to go back and get them, but after Watergate, he continued lying. That's what's wrong with Richard Nixon. He was an evil little man, and he abandoned those boys as Henry Kissinger did. Help us get the truth out while there's still time. Help us to rally people behind the principles of once made America the envy of the world. Pray for our nation. Go to our website at radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com. Pray for revival, because if the Americans don't turn back to righteousness and to God, we're going to lose this great and noble nation. And finally, please remember to pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And so until tomorrow, we'll be back with you one final time for this week. Dr. Stan, good night, and may the Lord be with you.